It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Biden administration announced last week that it was canceling 7 oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska and proposing new regulations to protect Arctic wildlife lands. The leases were issued by the Trump administration as part of the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act. That law still requires the Biden administration to hold another sale of oil and gas leases in the area by December of next year. Environmental groups applauded the cancellation of the leases, but want to see the White House go further to halt ongoing oil and gas drilling in the Arctic. The Biden administration earlier this year approved permits for the controversial Willow Project from ConocoPhillips. Meanwhile, oil industry groups and many elected officials in Alaska criticized the decision to end the leases. We're learning more about the environmental policy and legal questions about what the Biden administration can and can't do with oil drilling in the Arctic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the way the Biden administration is handling environmental policy in the Arctic? Are you glad these leases got canceled? What do you think about that permit being issued? What questions do you have about some of the legal issues at play here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Squillaci is the Raphael J. Moses Professor of Natural Resources Law at the University of Colorado Law School. He worked for the U.S. Department of the Interior during the Clinton administration. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
This is a long-running debate over drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Can you set the scene for us a little bit? Tell us about this place, its oil prospects, and why this has been so controversial over the years.
Yeah, well, Alaska is just an interesting place in many ways, right? It's a huge state and has abundant wildlife. In many places, there aren't a lot of people, but there are some incredible ecosystems that support a huge population of elk and reindeer and polar bears and other kinds of animals that we don't tend to find as much in the lower 48. And so it's been a really important place for many conservation groups and efforts to protect the area from encroachments by oil and gas companies and other kinds of development have been ongoing for many, many years.
How do these kind of leases work, like the ones that were just canceled? How does the government, the federal government, take this federal land and give the option to buy these leases to companies?
Yeah, really good question, Rob. So what they do is they hold an auction. And so first there's a process for nominating tracts for lease in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. I mean, as you pointed out, they were mandated by Congress to hold a lease sale, I think, before the end of 2021, and then a second one before the end of 2024. So there were two lease sales mandated by that statute. But generally speaking, this is done through a nomination process, and then the government schedules tracts that are available for lease, and they hold an auction, which is what they did in the case of the ANWR leases as well. They held an auction, and the leases generally go to the highest bidder. What's really interesting about the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge leases is that there was very little interest in developing those leases. Except for one case, all the leases that ended up being sold were sold essentially to an arm of the state of Alaska. I think Alaska was concerned that nobody else was interested in those leases, and they just bought them so they could hold them, I guess, and hope that maybe they could transfer them to another party who would actually develop the oil and gas on the property. But it's a really telling result. The fact that there was so little interest in acquiring those leases in ANWR suggests to me that that land is not likely to ever be developed. And so whether or not the government had canceled these leases, I was skeptical that development would ever occur on that tract of land.
One argument I've seen is that, if I'm an oil company and I'm looking at a Biden administration that said, hey, we want to end drilling on federal lands, well, maybe if I bid and get this lease, it might get yanked out from under me, as these leases did. Could that be contributing to that lack of interest?
Possibly. The government will likely have to repay the bonus bids that the state paid and that the single private bidder paid if they're canceling those leases because they didn't have a chance to develop those leases. But I don't really know that these leases were worth as much as was sort of suggested before the tracks went for up for sale. If there had been a lot of interest in the leases, I think you would have seen multiple bidders, and they would have bid the price of the tracks up quite high. But I think most people understand that it would be very difficult to develop the oil and gas on that tract of land, in part because it's somewhat remote from the Trans-Alaska pipeline. It would have been expensive to move the oil and gas over to the pipeline. And at the end of the day, they also know that because it's so controversial to develop in that area, they were going to likely face a lot of litigation, even if they were allowed to get permits to do it. So, from the perspective of an oil and gas company, that was a big risk proposition. And also, I think what oil and gas companies are realizing is that the long-term prospects for oil and gas are not good. It's pretty clear that we're moving toward electrification of the grid. It's pretty clear that we're moving toward electrification of transportation. And both of those things are going to affect demand for oil and for gas, and likely then the price. And so if these companies can't develop this oil and gas resource at a significant profit, why would they go forward and try to bid on these tracts of land? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Now, in the short term, there clearly is some continuing demand for oil and gas, and the price has remained somewhat stubbornly high, in part because of price constraints that have been imposed by OPEC Plus and others, by Russia to some extent. And so the price has been sufficiently high that oil and gas companies are able to make a decent profit. But I just don't see how this is going to play out in that way over the long term. As the demand goes down for oil because of the increased electrification of transportation, as the demand goes down for gas, as we see more and more renewable energy coming on the grid, it seems to me that the price is inevitably going to fall and make a lot of these speculative kinds of development projects unprofitable. And that's, I think, why the majors didn't bid on the ANWR leases. I think they're looking ahead, they're realizing that it's going to take a while to develop those leases, in part because of the controversy and efforts to block the development of those leases. We're also likely to see that with respect to the Willow project that you mentioned. And so if you're an oil and gas company, you have to be thinking that it's going to take maybe a decade, maybe more, to actually get that oil and gas to market. And where's the market going to be in a decade? I think that's a really tough question to answer. And I think what we're seeing, or what we have seen particularly up in Alaska, is that there's been a reluctance for the majors, at least, to spend a lot of money to develop the properties up there. It's just too speculative, I think, at this point in time.
Talking to Mark Scolacci, natural resources law professor at the University of Colorado Law School, looking at drilling for oil in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the federal government be encouraging development of oil and natural gas wherever and whenever we can? Or are you glad to see the recent cancellation of some of these leases there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's look at that Willow project now. Environmentalists largely happy about the cancellation of these leases. Unhappy, though, with the Biden administration approving the permit for that Willow project from ConocoPhillips to drill in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. Now, this is a different stage of the process, as I understand it, Mark. Correct me if I'm wrong. The lease was already there. This permit says, okay, yeah, we're approving your plan to drill using this lease.
Right. Right. So we talked a little bit at the beginning about how this goes. And as I mentioned, there's an auction to decide who gets to buy the lease. After the lease is purchased, then the company that has the lease has a right to develop that property, but not in any particular way. They still have to apply to the government for what's called a permit to drill. And so we talk about this as an application for a permit to drill, or an APD. That has to go through a whole environmental process on its own. And that's what Willow was able to obtain from the government, the permit to drill on that land. And we'll see where it goes. I think the government's decision in that particular case gave them a limited amount of access to the area and limited the number of drilling wells that they could drill on the property. So it wasn't a wholesale win for the company, but nonetheless, they're going to be allowed to develop that property. And as you mentioned, it's pretty controversial. I expect there will be litigation over their efforts to drill that property. Maybe they'll be able to get it to market before the price comes down too much. Maybe they'll be able to make a profit. I think the Willow Project is an interesting one just in terms of thinking about where oil and gas development is going. And I think one thing we need to accept is that for the short term, at least, there is going to continue to be sufficient demand for oil and gas that we're likely to need more development, including some development on public lands, maybe development in Alaska. What I would really like to see, though, is the federal government acknowledging that we need to start managing the decline of this resource. Over time, it seems pretty clear to me that we're going to need less and less of this resource. And so we should be managing how that takes place, making sure, for example, that this doesn't lead to wholesale bankruptcies in the oil and gas industry. That really is very disruptive to communities that depend on it. It's very disruptive to the employees who work for those companies. And oftentimes, as we've seen with the coal industry, when these big companies go bankrupt, they leave the workers and the communities in a lurch. And the CEOs tend to make out like bandits in this process. And so that's something that we shouldn't repeat in the oil and gas industry. We're going to have to recognize that in a decade, maybe two, we're going to be seeing a lot less oil and gas being developed. And how are we going to get there? What's the path that we're going to take to make sure that these dislocations that we've seen in the coal industry don't occur in oil and gas? And so Willow's going to be interesting. Maybe they'll get it in under the wire so that they can make a decent profit in developing the resource there. We'll have to wait and see. We'll have to wait and see if there are delays as a result of litigation or other kinds of concerns. But I would say from ConocoPhillips' perspective, this is a risky project. It's not just risky in terms of the environmental impacts, but it is risky in terms of their bottom line. And it's going to be interesting to watch to see how successful they are.
We're talking to University of Colorado law professor Mark Squillaci about the Biden administration pausing oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, while, as we just mentioned, giving a permit for an already existing lease earlier this year. What it all means for the U.S. oil drilling and environmental landscapes. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this? Have you been following this for maybe two, three decades? What do you want to see the White House do when it comes to oil drilling leases and permits in this Arctic wildlife refuge? Should we be putting more emphasis into getting oil and natural gas where we can find it in the U.S., or should we be working to de-oilify, if that's a word? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mark Squillaci, natural resources law professor at the University of Colorado, with us today to check in on U.S. oil drilling in the Arctic as the Biden administration canceled oil leases at the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, while the controversial Willow Project continues with a permit go-ahead from the White House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see these drilling projects for oil and natural gas go ahead in Alaskan wildlife areas? What questions do you have about some of the environmental laws involved in all of this? Should climate change considerations be part of the factors used in determining if these projects get the go-ahead? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Kent is with us in Reedstown. Kent, hi.
Yeah, hi. Aren't the oil companies making a big profit, a decent profit now, plus they get government subsidies?
Kent, thanks for the call. Mark, people talk about oil companies getting substantial subsidies. Is that something that's happening?
The oil and gas industry has long enjoyed some favorable treatment under our tax laws and other laws that makes them able to take advantage, I think, of government programs. And so, yes, that has been a problem. It's something that I think many people have wanted the government to address, and it needs to do more in that regard. But in terms of your larger question, I think it is important to look at what's happening right now in terms of the price of oil and gas. It's reasonably high. I think it's reasonably high partly because, or largely because, of the war in Ukraine and also the efforts by OPEC and Russia to limit the supply. And that just can't happen forever. I mean, they can do that temporarily, but there are too many countries involved in producing oil and gas in ways that likely mean that particularly as demand drops, the supply is going to outstrip that demand. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen maybe this year or even next year, maybe not in the next few years. So maybe that price will continue to be reasonably high. But think about it from the perspective of an oil and gas company. If you know that it's going to take 5 to 10, maybe longer years to develop a new oil and gas project, are you really going to risk the expense that it's going to take to develop that resource if you know that demand is going to drop significantly and likely the price with it? I mean, this is all speculation, of course. We don't know exactly how this is going to play out, but all indications are is that we're moving toward electrification of both the transportation sector and the utility sector. And that has got to have a significant impact on supply. And this is just basic economics. Supply and demand likely are going to dictate what happens to the price. So if I'm an oil and gas major and I'm looking at the economics of this, and I think most of these companies have acknowledged this, that the long-term prospects for this industry are not great. Short-term, it's anybody's guess. And as long as the war continues and as long as OPEC can exert its authority, yes, they're going to make a profit irrespective of the tax breaks that they may be able to get. But I just don't know that that's going to continue. And particularly when you're looking at projects in a place like Alaska, which are going to be harder to develop, more expensive to develop, and won't be developed for a number of years yet. I think that's a very risky kind of proposition.
Go back to our callers. Ernest is with us in Hayward. Ernest, hi.
Hi. One way to decrease the demand for that Alaska oil and gas is with a carbon tax, but that is a no-no because whether you are a climate change denier or not, you tend to be a carbon tax denier.
Ernest, thanks for the call. Mark, that's a policy tool people have pointed toward as a way to, make that transition away from the oil, natural gas, and coal, the carbon tax idea. I don't know if that's a policy area you focus on yourself, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all of us who deal with these issues have talked about carbon taxes. It's a pretty interesting idea. I think it would be a successful strategy that could be used. I just don't think the politics in the United States, at least, are there yet in terms of imposing a carbon tax. And one thing that we learned from the Inflation Reduction Act is that the thing that probably works best is just government subsidies. Now, we could argue about whether that's appropriate or not, but we have seen the subsidies that have been adopted in the Inflation Reduction Act dramatically change the picture for renewable energy and for electric vehicles in a pretty significant way that I think is likely to have really long-term effects. And we could argue about carbon taxes, and we can argue about other strategies like cap and trade programs for carbon that I think would work from an administrative perspective, maybe are good ideas, but we have to look at the reality of the politics of these kinds of issues. And for better or worse, putting some money in and basically incentivizing people to switch to renewable forms of energy makes a lot of sense. And it partly makes a lot of sense because it basically is paying for the externalities that these fossil fuel companies are imposing on all of us. You know, whenever you talk about the subsidies that they might receive, we're not even thinking about the subsidies that they receive because they're not having to pay for the external costs of their carbon pollution. And so it does make a lot of sense, I think, to incentivize people to move toward renewable energy and new batteries that can power our transportation sector. I mean, those are really significant changes that came about largely because of the Inflation Reduction Act. And I think people have marveled at how successful those programs have already been. And they are contributing to a lot of private investment that is helping to jumpstart this whole renewable energy economy. So I'm really encouraged by some of those programs. I'm not opposed to a carbon tax. I just think politically it's not likely to happen. And so I'm really pleased that we're looking at this from a number of different angles. And from my perspective, what seems to be working now are these subsidy programs.
Mark, just a point of personal curiosity. I was booking segments on this Anwar story 20, 30 years ago. And yeah. It seemed like it was front page news then and really heated. It seems less so now. since then, we've had fracking that lets us get to oil and natural gas in much more reachable areas. Is that why maybe there's not as much heat over this Alaska thing as maybe there was 20, 30 years ago, just in our last minute and a half or so?
It's a really good point. I mean, the oil and gas development that has occurred in the lower 48 has been significant at a time when people thought we were running out of oil and gas. All of a sudden, because of these new technologies, and we talk about fracking a lot, but it's really about horizontal drilling, which sort of changed the industry, which allows you basically to go vertically into a oil shale formation up to 2, 3, or even 5 miles and frack that whole area and pull the oil and gas out of that resource, which is something that just wasn't possible until about a decade ago. And so we've really seen a resurgence in the domestic oil and gas industry in the lower 48 that has really changed the picture for oil and gas development in this country. And so I think that has dampened perhaps the demand or the need to develop the oil and gas in Alaska. I mean, some people think that, you know, we're back at the point of maybe having already developed the better resources in the lower 48, but it seems to me there's still quite a bit of oil and gas development that is occurring and that is likely to occur probably at a lower price point than developing that oil and gas in Alaska. So I don't think we're going to see an end to the development of the lower 48. It may decline a bit just because of the resource, but as I indicated, I think that we're going to be seeing a decline in demand over time. And as that happens, I think it's just not going to be as profitable for these companies to argue in high-cost areas like Alaska.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You bet.
That's Mark Squillaci, the Raphael J. Moses Professor of Natural Resources Law at the University of Colorado Law School. He was with us today to talk about Biden administration policy and environmental laws on oil drilling in Alaskan wildlife areas. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Kate brings on a panel of guests for a look at the health of American democracy and the impact of former President Trump's effort to overturn the 2020 election results. It's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Here's a question I didn't know I wanted the answer to, but now there's an answer, partly. What did mummies smell like? As reported in the Washington Post, visitors to a museum in Denmark will soon be able to smell the scent of one of the perfumes used in the mummification process in ancient Egypt. They can do that because of an urn from 3,500 years ago. Using chemical spectrography, researchers were able to recreate the residue found at the bottom of the urn. According to a press release, the scent mixture included beeswax, plant oil, fats, bitumen, pine resins, most likely larch, a balsamic substance, and damar or pistachia tree resin. I don't know what that's going to smell like, but researchers worked with a perfumer to recreate the scent. I'm all for recreating the smells of history, and who knows? Maybe this will end up in perfumes and colognes that we can all try sometime. Patent pending. This is Central Time.